Great. Well, thank you all for being here. It's an honor and a privilege to be making a presentation to this group, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I want to talk about one dimension of the externalized costs of the food system. Tyler said I should introduce myself. I'm Pete Myers. I'm CEO and Chief Scientist of Environmental Health Sciences, which is a science-based NGO in Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm also an adjunct professor of chemistry at Carnegie Mellon University. I've been wandering in the fields of endocrine disruption for over 25 years. I was one of the three authors of Our Stolen Future 20 years ago that really broke that issue for the public. And at that time, we were in the scientific wilderness. Very few people in public health or medicine or even except in a narrow field of endocrinology recognized that endocrine disruption might be a significant public health issue. I will make a few comments demonstrating that we're out of the wilderness now, and one of the demonstrations of that was that four of us, including me, received a major award from the Endocrine Society for the 2016 Laureate Awards for Outstanding Public Service. And I don't know how many of you know the Endocrine Society, but if you've got an endocrinologically related disease, they're the go-to people. They're the world's experts in endocrinology. So for me, to have started as far out as I did to now be honored by them at the 2016 meeting is a really big deal. So, disclosure, no relationships to disclose. We live in a world today of endocrine-related epidemics. There's no question about that. Those are a few of them. And for everyone, every single condition on that slide, there is evidence, varying degrees of certainty, but there is evidence in the peer-reviewed literature that endocrine-disrupting chemicals may be contributing. None of these diseases are single factor. They're all multifactorial diseases, and endocrine disruption appears to be playing a role. This was acknowledged by the World Health Organization in 2013. They published a report along with the United Nations Environment Program on endocrine disrupting chemicals. These are the key points out of that report, but the central finding of that was that WHO now considers endocrine disruption to be a global public health threat. Those are their words. And the Endocrine Society has endocrine disruption as their principal focus for their public health work. So, what did the report say? First of all, there are too many of these things rising too rapidly to be changes in gene frequency. We know there are about 800 chemicals in common use that disrupt the endocrine function, but most chemicals in use have not been tested for these endpoints. They just haven't been tested. So 800 is a place to begin. We know that exposure is ubiquitous. There is not a person on Earth who does not contain contamination of multiple endocrine disrupting compounds. Lots of studies in the peer-reviewed literature, lab studies, in vitro cell work, lots of wildlife studies, and also a large body of epidemiological literature that's consistent with the lab and laboratory work. WHO concluded that the disease risks due to EDCs, endocrine disrupting compounds, may be significantly underestimated for no other reason than we don't know the full panoply of endocrine disrupting compounds that are out there. WHO also concluded that there are significant opportunities for disease prevention if we start to reduce exposures. I find that to be the most helpful element of that report. And if you think about it, if we could get the regulatory system work properly, which it doesn't, it's actually easier, I think, to reduce exposures, and we have good examples of having done that with some chemicals, than getting stubborn people to change their lifestyles. So, there are several key pillars to this science that have emerged over the last 25 years. I don't have time to go through them all. I'm going to focus on three. One is that low doses matter a lot. A second is that events in the womb don't stay in the womb. They can develop throughout the life of the exposed individual. And the third is that mixtures are everywhere, and they amplify effects. So if I go through the first one, low doses matter a lot. I'm going to show you an example out of the laboratory of Tyrone Hayes at UC Berkeley, who was the youngest tenured faculty member at Berkeley ever. Tyrone works on African clawed toads. These are the lab rats of amphibia. And the thing about this picture is that those are actually two genetic males. What's happened? They've been exposed to 2.5 parts per billion of atrazine as they were metamorphosing from tadpole to adult. 2.5 parts per billion. And the consequence was to take about 10% of the exposed tadpoles that are genetic males and convert them in growth to fully functional, fertilizable females. Both males, those are the eggs that the nail female laid. This does not happen in frogdom normally. This is the result of exposure to one of the most widely used herbicides in the food system, atrazine, which is used on crops like corn, crops like sorghum. It led Syngenta to having to pay, who's the manufacturer of atrazine, a $100 million lawsuit to settle with water systems throughout the Midwest that were too contaminated to meet EPA standards. Let's think about what 2.5 parts per billion means. This is a log scale. Shows you where 2.5 would be on that log scale. If you're a farmer and you're applying atrazine on those fields, you want to get it to about 1.2 million parts per billion on the field. If you measure runoff on the off the fields, it's about 8,000 parts per billion. If you measure streams downstream from the runoff, it's maybe 150 parts per billion. EPA's short-term safety level for exposure is 100 parts per billion. If you measure surface water in the lakes into which those streams flow, it's about 80 parts per billion. EPA's safe level is 3 parts per billion for continuous exposure. It's just a little bit higher than what can change a genetic male frog into a fully functional female. And actually, because atrazine volatilizes, it evaporates on the crops, rises into the clouds, condenses in the raindrops in the clouds, it's carried downstream, it can be measured hundreds of miles downstream in rain at 1 part per billion. So low doses can have big effects. Second pillar of this science is that events in the womb don't stay in the womb. Some of you, most of you, I hope, have heard about the theory of developmental origins of adult disease. It came out of epidemiological work done in Europe, focused on nutrition initially, but now this theme is going like gangbusters in the world of endocrine disruption, because low-dose exposures in the womb can cause effects that may not be manifest until much later in life. Some of them are visible immediately, but some of them take a long time to develop, and I'm going to give you one example of that. This is the inside of a mouse. It's a mouse about my age in mouse years. It's the control. Note the kidneys, the bladder. It happens to be a male. What would have happened had that mouse been exposed to 20 parts per billion of bisphenol A in utero? How many of you have heard of bisphenol A? Potent estrogen. That's what the inside of that mouse would have looked like. This is the experimental animal. Its kidneys have gone completely necrotic. Its bladder literally is about to explode. If that mouse had not been sacrificed for this experiment, it's highly likely it would have exploded. Remember, that's my age in mouse years. It took until late adulthood, I think it's late, for that condition to truly manifest. What happened? Well, if you think about how urine gets from the bladder to the outside world, it goes through the urethra, correct? Okay. And the urethra in a male goes through the prostate. It passes through the prostate gland. And there's some tissue on that part of the urethra that reacts epigenetically to bisphenol A if the exposure takes place early in life in the womb. And what happens is so epigenetics involves changes in how genes are turned on and off. And what this exposure did was it altered the way that the aging urethra responds to changes in testosterone and estrogen late in life. And gradually, that urethra, the tissue in that urethra, constricts until the animal can no longer pee. That's not normal. Mixtures are ubiquitous, and they can amplify effects. The CDC has established very, very clearly that each of us has hundreds of different chemicals in us now. Epidemiology has shown that those levels can be relevant, although they are not always. So we have mixtures. Those are inescapable. We now have a large body of literature that asks, what if you combine different chemicals that work through the same mechanism of action, say all estrogen, multiple chemicals that are all estrogens? You have them all at low doses. Doses too low to have an effect by themselves. You combine them in a mixture, they will have an effect, a demonstrable effect. There's a lot of published studies on that. Just this spring, a new concept was introduced that was published in Carcinogenesis, assessing the carcinogenic potential of low-dose mixtures and looking at it in a different way. Instead of taking chemicals that behave the same, they took chemicals that did different things. Do any of you know the theory of the hallmarks of cancer? Where cancer is, some chemicals cause cancer by being mutagens, and they can do it by themselves. But what this theory focuses on is how, if it's not a simple mutagenic event, then there have to be multiple physiological changes within cells that add up through what are called the hallmarks of cancer, to collectively causing that cell or that tissue to become carcinoma. And so about 175 scientists were involved in publishing this. The National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences immediately convened a meeting this August to discuss its relevance. NIEHS is going to start putting serious money into exploring this. But I want you to think of it as the Ocean's 11 effect. If you think about, how many of you saw the movie? Or 12 or 13? If all of those guys had been George Clooney clones, it wouldn't have worked. They needed the small guy to get into the ventilation. They needed the big tough guy to boot some people out. They needed a collection of different skill sets to achieve the heist. And that's what this hypothesis says. With different chemicals, each targeting different aspects of the hallmarks of cancer, you can have a mixture of chemicals be carcinogenic, even though the tests of individual chemicals would never have suggested it. Does that make sense? None of the regulatory processes looking for carcinogenicity even have begun to think about this. So, think about the food system. From field to fork, okay? I want to ask, where are there chemical vulnerabilities for contamination in the food system? Well, it begins in the field because, like that atrazine being applied, that's heavy. And typical fields can be treated with 20-plus chemicals during the growing season, different chemicals. Food has to be handled once it's harvested. This is a milking operation. A public health scientist, a pediatrician at University of Washington, Sheila Sayanarathara, published a really fascinating paper a couple of years ago where she took kids and had them, one set of them eat organic food and the other set eat conventional food. And then she tested for certain endocrine disrupting compounds and predicted that the organic food was going to have fewer chemicals in it, right? Well, it turns out somewhere in the handling of the spices used to make those organic foods led the organic foods to be more contaminated than the conventional ones by a lot. So this is a big this part of the process, somewhere in the processing, some phthalates got introduced, and the biggest the highest exposure was in turmeric. Another point of vulnerability: how do we transport the food? Processing. We process food with all sorts of equipment, and it can get dirty or it can get contaminated. It can be made of materials that leach. Every plastic tube in a system like that is potentially made of a plastic that leaches phthalates, for example. Packaging. Microwave popcorn. How many of you eat microwaved popcorn? The high likelihood is that there are perfluorinated compounds coating the inside of that package that leach into the popcorn as it's heated. Philippe Brongine from Harvard School of Public Health has recently published studies showing that these perfluorinated compounds reduce a child's ability to produce antibodies after exposure to a vaccine by a lot. So Denmark just outlawed the use of perfluorinated compounds for this and a bunch of other uses in the food system. I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg. Any of you own these black plastic spatulas? They're pretty common. They're made of a plastic that leaches polycyclic aromatic amines, which are carcinogenic and have been banned by Denmark. I was staying at a health retreat center in California. Any of you know Commonweal? And this place prides itself on helping sick people get better and helping healthy people stay well. Their kitchen was full of this stuff. It no longer is. And lastly, we have to store food also. And there are vulnerabilities in each of these places because our understanding of what chemicals, what materials come into contact with food throughout this entire chain is so limited and so subject to protection by the companies that make it. This information is not publicly accessible. I was at a meeting of the Food Packaging Forum, which is based in Zurich, a month ago. Whole discussion of all these issues. What are the chemicals into which food comes into contact with? And a guy from Nestle was there presenting on what they're doing about this, and they're really worried because they made a mistake with the ink on a package, and they had a lot of it out in the market, and it cost them over $100 million to get the stuff back from the market and figure out what the replacement was. He was complaining there about the opacity of this information, and he said, I looked and looked and looked for a good example of someone who was had full disclosure of what their materials were, and the only one I could find were the wrappings used by Philip Morris for cigarettes. So what do we know about economic externalities in this endocrine disruption in the food system? The studies are now beginning to come out. The Nordic government published one on male reproductive impairments having to do with reduced sperm count, hypospadias, cryptorchidism, a series of things that are pretty clearly linked to exposure to the antiandrogens like phthalates. They estimate that for male reproductive impacts alone, it's somewhere between 59 to 1.1 billion euros a year. An NGO published a similar estimate, except instead of looking at just one reproductive endpoint, they looked at a series of endocrine-related diseases, totaled the entire cost to the health system for treating those, and then said, well, let's imagine, and that total came to 636 billion euros a year in Europe, and then they said, let's try and think of what a reasonable percentage of that might be due to endocrine disrupting compounds. And their central tendency was an estimate of 31 billion. More recently, a group of us, led by Leo Trasandi at New York University, did a much more sophisticated Markovian modeling approach to this question, using tools developed by the Institute of Medicine and the World Health Organization, where we needed information. There were about 30 scientists involved in this and economists. We needed information that tells something about the dose response curve in experiments, the dose response curve evident in epidemiological data, the health costs, et cetera. And IOM offered a way to integrate all that information. Notably, you needed to have dose response information. And we could find dose response information sufficient to feed the models of only 5% of known endocrine disrupting compounds. So here on your right are in black, well, first of all, the central tendency in this Markovian estimate was 157 billion euros a year for these 5% of known endocrine disrupting compounds for a very restricted set of endocrine-related diseases. This is all published now, and I'd be happy to give you the reference. What you can see there is that we break it down in two ways. On the right, you have the compounds and the classes of compounds, and on the left, you have the health effects. And you see the two big results. 120 billion is attributable to pesticide exposures, and endocrine disrupting pesticides. And the 132 billion blue column shows that most of the health costs were associated with drops in IQ that led to reduced productivity. That's a concept that economists find it easy to work with. And it turns out that most of that was due to organophosphate pesticides, and most of that is in the food system. Okay? So there is a lot we don't know. For example, some of you probably have been hearing about the controversy over glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, the most widely used herbicide in the world. Its use has increased over 100-fold since it became the centerpiece of Roundup-ready crops, genetically modified crops like corn, GMO corn and GMO soy. We were told it was safe. Why? Because the herbicidal action, the mechanism of action, was via a enzyme pathway that does not exist in people. It kills plants through that mechanism of action, but that they concluded that since it's not there in people, it can't hurt people. That was the mantra for almost four decades. But gradually, independent scientists began to test the hypothesis, well, maybe there are other mechanisms of action that this chemical uses. It turns out it's a chelating agent. In fact, it was originally discovered and patented in the 1970s as a chelating agent, which is a completely different mechanism of action. And what it does is it grabs metals and makes those metal nutrients unavailable, both in people, in food, and in the soil. We've also discovered that it murders soil nutrition. It kills the microbiota that are in the soil wherever Roundup is used. And it's used because of its role in GMO agriculture, it's used on hundreds of millions of acres in the Western Hemisphere today. Lots of different uses, which I think I'm probably running out of time, so I'll move on. Today, on Monsanto's website, they make a series of claims which independent science is disproving. They still claim that it's not a risk to people. They say it has very low acute toxicity. They say it doesn't affect development, and there's no endocrine disruption. All those have now been challenged by independent studies and very inconvenient data. This is a really important analysis of all this, published in Environmental and Analytical Toxicology by Michael Antonio, which dissects in great detail the European decision on glyphosate safety and shows that it's what they estimate to be the safe level is significantly over, and it's too high an estimate. Glyphosate is not as safe as Europe claims. It is an endocrine disruptor at really low levels. It affects the estrogen signaling. It also affects retinoic acid signaling, which is, if you remember your classes in this field, changes in retinoic acid signaling lead to birth defects. And that's been shown experimentally in animals, and there's some epidemiological data emerging, particularly from the most heavily used areas of glyphosate and Roundup, which are Argentina and Brazil. And then IARC published, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, part of WHO, published its conclusion this March, saying that glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen. And a lot's been happening since. France is taking it off the market. Lawsuits are building up in the U.S. From individuals. California is putting it on its carcinogenic list. It's likely that compound will disappear from the market in many countries in the next few years. So, what has been the result of all this discovery in endocrine disruption research? We have been able to get to reduce exposures to some degree for a small number of chemicals. For most, we haven't. There have been some significant public health wins as a result of this. For example, Ricky Pereira at Columbia University has shown that once chlorpyrifos was taken off the market for domestic use, they had fewer incidences of small head size in babies born to people living in Dominican Heights and elsewhere in New York. But here we are, we're making little bits of progress, and yet we have this onslaught of that collection of chronic endocrine-related diseases that I began with. And I guess I kind of react, and then the other thing is, we're continuing to manufacture new ones with almost not using the knowledge that we have about this challenge. So I react like this. What is the matter with this picture? And I end by challenging you all to think about how we can work together to do a better job at reversing these trends in public health through exposure reduction and help reduce the externalized cost of the food system. Thank you.